Play always has lots of room for creativity. Play is always creative. It is something that you are constantly producing your version of what to do.
You know, I have three children. I can very clearly see it. And I'm in that kind of sweet window that you're describing. I have a pre-K, a K, and a first grade, you know, so I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it in real time right now.
But the thing to know is that children are designed to play. They absolutely need play. They don't need to be told how to play.
You wish all parents knew one thing about play, just one. What would it be? Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Sensory Play Reimagined, a podcast exploring how sensory play can help unlock your child's development and well-being potential. I'm Rachel Rothman, a toy expert and mom of three. Today, we are pleased to have Dr. Peter Gray on the podcast with us. Just such an expert in terms of all things play, a renowned research professor at Boston College, an author of Free to Learn, and so, so much more that I can't wait to dive into. So just to kick it off, Dr. Gray, maybe you can just give, you know, a quick spiel on who you are, what does it mean to be a researcher of play, and, you know, what you're doing currently professionally.
Okay, well, I'm a research professor of psychology and neuroscience at Boston College. I'm no longer teaching there. I resigned from my typical full professorship quite some years ago and accepted a title of research professor. But I have long been studying children's play in various ways. I got interested in it many years ago when my son was rebelling in school. And so we transferred him to a radically alternative school. And I got interested in, for partly out of my concern as a parent, how the graduates of this school did. So I did a study of the graduates. This is a school where children are, and teens, it goes from kids that are there from age four on through the late teenage years, are playing, exploring, following their own interests all day long. And it's very different from what we usually think of as school. But it was the only school my son was willing to go to. And so I was certainly open to it, but I had some concerns. And so I did a study of the graduates of the school. This was a long time ago. And they were doing very well in the world, remarkably well in the world. And that really got me. So first of all, that made me happy as a parent. I was no longer quite so worried that he was going to be ruining his future by going to this alternative, radically alternative school. But it definitely also piqued my curiosity as a scholar. I had been doing a very different kind of laboratory research before with laboratory rodents. But I began, after that study, to begin to study play. What is it? You know, these children are obviously becoming well-educated, and nobody's educating them. They're just playing, they're exploring, they're talking, they're following their own interests, they're doing a lot of interesting things, but they're kind of doing just what you would expect kids would do when they're free to do what they want to do. It doesn't look like they're doing school in any particular way, and yet they're going on well-educated by any reasonable definition of education. They're happy in their life. They seem to be living a very moral life. They go on to higher education if they want, even though they have met none of the official academic requirements to go into college, yet they get into college if they want to do that. And they're in good careers that they're happy with. So by any reasonable definition, they are well-educated. And so then the question was, how did they become well-educated? And of course, that led me to do research where I was paying much more attention to what children are really doing when they're playing and when they're exploring and when they're left more to their own devices than we normally allow them to do. And once you start paying attention to that, it's just remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. And so I got drawn into a study to research on play and have pursued that in a variety of ways ever since.
I have to pause you to just say, we are doing this podcast selfishly for me to speak to experts like you to better my own personal family as well. So in our pursuits of what we are doing professionally to marry that for the benefit of our children, we are very aligned. And I similarly found with my own children, play being so instrumental to all of their development. I'm currently sitting inside my kids' playroom, and the entire reason we moved to where we are is because there was a large finished basement that my children could just do completely open play in. So we are very much aligned in following pursuits for the benefit of our children, and hopefully through this also helping so many others. So just a testament to all that you've done. Your child may have been your impetus for doing it, but you have impacted so many lives through your work and through your research. So a thank you for all of that. Through your research, you have come up with kind of a defining principles of what play is. And I think that's what you were about to lead into when I interrupted you, regarding what were those commonalities that you were seeing that you eventually came to define as play. People look at play as a lot of different things. If I were to ask you as a researcher, what does play mean to you? What does that mean to you?
Sure. Like a lot of English words, play has a lot of different meanings, some of which are closely related to one another, some of which are not very closely related to one another. So what do I, and it can be confusing when people talk about play. So for example, when people say, well, we have a play-based kindergarten, they may not be using the word play in the same way I would use it. So so what do I mean by play? And basically my definition of play comes partly from looking at what other scholars and researchers have studied play over the years, how they've kind of defined it or what the implicit definition of play is if you look at their work, and partly from my own observations about the category of activity that seems to be a fairly definable category of activity that I'm interested in. So by my definition, play is an activity that involves four characteristics. And as I name these characteristics, I'm going to also say something about how each of these characteristics leads play to be such a powerful vehicle for children's learning and development. So the first characteristic of play is that it is self-chosen and self-directed by the players. So if some authority figure says, now, children, we're all going to play this, by my definition, right off, it's not play. Play is something that the children decide to do and that the children direct. Among the most important purposes of play from an evolutionary perspective of why children play, what is it that they get from play, is how to take charge of their own life, how to initiate their own activities, how to direct their own activities, how to solve their own problems. So to the degree that adults get involved in children's play, it's generally not play, because adults almost can't resist, at least in our culture today, in some sense, taking charge of the play. So that's the first defining character, something that children choose on their own to do and direct on their own. The other thing that I want to mention about this aspect of play is, I said it's self-chosen, self-directed, but yeah, most children, when they have the opportunity, want to play with other children. Throughout the world, where we don't separate children as we do so much in our culture, but where children can easily congregate with other children, most of children's play is social with other children. And so when a group of children are playing together, they have to decide together what they're playing. They have to decide together how to play. That means that play involves a lot of negotiation. I want to play this, you want to play that. What What might we both want to play? I want to play this way, but you want to play that way. How do we work this out? So children, even very young children, you can watch, see four-year-olds doing this, engage in real, but if you watch closely, pretty sophisticated negotiation about what they're playing, who gets to play what part, who has to play what other part. There's a lot of discussion of what's fair and not fair.
My kids are much better at negotiating than I am. I think we lose it along the way. We stop playing. But my children are masterful negotiators. It's very true.
Yeah, well, that's good. So the so think already, just on the basis of what I've said so far about what children are learning in play. Also related to this, I might say that the most important freedom in play is freedom to quit. If you can't quit, it's not play. And the ability to quit is what makes play so democratic, because, you know, if a group of children want to play something and one child begins to dominate and act like everybody else is supposed to do what he or she wants them to do, the others will just quit. In the world that I grew up in, they would go home. We would be outside playing, and the kids who felt like that's no fun anymore, I don't want to play with you because you're doing, they would say something like, you know, I hear my mom calling, I'm going home now. So the lesson that the person learns who has been dominating and maybe being a little bullying and not listening to playmates is, oh, next time I better pay more attention to what my playmates want. Otherwise they're going to leave me. That's the natural punishment, if you will, for not playing in a cooperative way with your playmates. So, you know, one of the most important things children learn in play, in social play, is how to pay attention to whether their playmates are happy or not, and how to modify their own behavior if they perceive that their playmates are not happy. So that's the first character, self-chosen, self-directed, freedom to quit. The second characteristic is that it's intrinsically motivated, which means that it's done for its own sake. You're not doing it for some reward outside of itself. You're not doing it for a gold star or a trophy or praise from a parent or from a teacher. You know, to the degree that nobody wants you to do it, but you do it anyway, it's play. That play is what you want to do because you just really enjoy doing it. You're not doing it for some end outside of itself. It's that aspect of play that I think leads a lot of people to think it's a waste of time. Why would you spend time doing something that you're not getting some kind of an extrinsic reward from? We're such a, I suppose, capitalist society. We think you're supposed to be rewarded in some way for everything you do. Otherwise, why do it? But play is something you do because you like to do it. Now, among other things, what happens because of play then is you discover what you like to do. You play at various things, and you play especially at the things that you like to do. Now, I've studied children who have lots of time to play growing up, and what I found is that many of them discover what we might call their passions, their passionate interests, and they become good at it. And then they go on to do that as a career later on in their life.
And so I was just going to say, do you think it follows that order, like for the most part, that they're enjoying it and then they get good at it? Or do you think they're good at it and then they...
Oh, no, they're enjoying it and then they get good at it. They get good at it because they do it for so intensely for such a long time. And they begin doing it when they're too young, really, to be good at it, generally speaking. I mean, let me just give you an example of that. So in my initial study of the graduates of Sudbury Valley School, about half of them, I could tell a story about a direct relationship between what they played at as a child and their career. So here's just one example at the time of my study, a young woman who was captain of a cruise ship. Now, she began playing with boats as a little girl on the pond at the school, was fascinated by boats, read about boats, and developed a dream of becoming a ship captain. By the time she was a teenager, she was taking leave from the school, you know, time off from the school to apprentice herself to a ship captain on Cape Cod. And by the time she was, you know, 19 or 20, she was ready for her dream job. That's just one story. I could tell many other stories. So she didn't play with boats because she was a good ship captain. She became a ship captain because she played with boats and got involved with that. So that's the second characteristic. You know, another way to think about this.
Before you go on to the third, I did want to ask a question. Is there anything as parents we can do to help reinforce the intrinsic motivation? Like, I'm mindful of not saying to my kids all the time, like, I'm so proud of you. Of course I say it, I'm a parent, it comes out, but it's more the, you should be so proud. Is that helpful? Is there language we should be using or nothing? Like, just don't talk about it.
Here's the problem. The best thing that adults can do to help kids learn their intrinsic motivations is get out of the way. Get out of the way. But I say that recognizing it's not so easy to do that in our culture today. The kids I'm talking about were going to this special school where the staff stayed out of their way and their parents were not there. So they had lots of time to do this. I've also studied unschooling families. So these are homeschoolers where the parents don't give the kids a curriculum and they give the kids lots of time to play and explore, and they help connect their kids with other kids. So they have other kids to play and explore, but the parents don't see it as their job to direct their children's development. They see it as their job to provide a healthy environment in which the children direct their own environment. Now, that's the environment, historically, that's the environment that children always grew up in, except for relatively modern times. And so, but it's difficult today to provide that kind of environment because kids are in schools where they're never left alone. They're always told what to do. They're micromanaged. They're given all kinds of boring tasks to do, and they're judged constantly by it. They're continuously rewarded and punished for their behavior. They consider learning to be something you do for reward, which of course makes it the opposite from play. So the school environment is a terrible environment for this to occur. And then homes bend to the school. So homes become like the school. Parents are encouraged to monitor their kids' homework, to even start teaching them at home. And so kids can't escape from school. So it becomes very difficult. It's in, you know, this is a challenge maybe we can talk about later on in the podcast about how do you provide an environment in today's world where children are free from adults and can interact in the way children are designed to interact with peers in play and to do the things that they really want to do. Now, that doesn't mean that parents can't play a useful role. But so, for example, let's suppose your child is interested in boats. Now, the last thing you want to do is push that interest. Don't start buying a lot of boat books. And don't act like now you're taking charge of this. But respond to the child's interest. If the child says, hey, I would really like to go to the library and look for books on boats, take the kid to the library to look for books on boats. But don't you take charge of it. This is the child's interest, the child's task, not yours. You'll snuff it. You'll snip it in the bud if you start pushing it, because then it makes it seem like this is something the child should be doing to please you rather than for the child's own sake. So this is a lesson for parents to learn today, to stay out of the way of their children, to facilitate the child's interest, but not push it.
I was just going to say, I'll give you a more modern analogous situation, which is pretty reckless of me. I'm going to say openly as everyone's listening to me, we allow our children to go on Amazon. They're not allowed to buy anything and we have set it up so that they can't, but just so that I can see what they're exploring and interested in, and they're smart enough through voice to be able to do it. So like I learned of some of my child's passion that he wasn't sharing with me. But anyway, it was just a way by which I was able to better understand what were the things that he was interested in. And he couldn't verbalize it yet or like draw a picture that was like communicating it to me. But ultimately we found out he was very excited for a superhero esque that we were able to figure out through this. So anyway, I digress to just say this was a reckless modern approach to enabling my child to communicate to me how they would like to facilitate some of their play. I don't suggest this for households, but anyway, we do try to not push it too far, but to provide the tools by which they could engage in the play that they would want. So it's challenging, you know, it's I think the modern world, again, we'll get into this in a little bit, creates a lot of constraints that make it very challenging for us to be able to do it. So I think in whatever ways we can also help, and I know you'll get into this, help support, well, in today, we do have all these things. How can we do it? I'm excited to get into that as well. And I did not mean to interrupt you. I'm excited for you to continue onto number three, if you don't mind.
All right.
Thank you. I'm going to keep interrupting you. I apologize.
That's fine. That's good. That's good. This is a conversation. So the third characteristic of play is that play is always structured. No such thing as unstructured play.
I love this one. I'm going to
need talk about unstructured play, yeah. And there's no such thing as unstructured play. Play is never random activity. It's always structured activity. You're always doing something when you play. And that something implies structure. You're making a sandcastle. This is a structured thing. You're not just randomly throwing sand around. you're having a play fight. You're right. Engaging in an activity that's similar in some ways to a fight, but has definite rules that prevent you from hurting one another. So play is always structured, and it's structured by the players themselves. It's how children learn how to structure their activities. Sometimes I say this as play always has rules, but by rules, I really mean guidelines. Sometimes some play has very clear rules, but in some play, it's sort of more guidelines. These are the things that you have to stay within the boundaries of this. Otherwise, it's no longer play. And so play is how children learn to structure their own activities. It's how they learn to control their impulses. So when children are playing together, especially, they have to control their impulses. They have to do what they're supposed to do in the play. So imagine a group of little children playing a typical little children fantasy game, maybe that they're superheroes. And so one little girl is Wonder Woman. And she has to act like Wonder Woman. She has to act the way Wonder Woman would act. So, you know, maybe she falls down and skins her knee, but Wonder Woman wouldn't cry. So she has to not cry unless she calls time out to cry and then goes back to playing Wonder Woman later on. Or if you're the pet dog, you have to walk around on all fours and you're not allowed to talk and you have to just go arf, arf, arf all the time. So there are all kinds of these rules, and so children have to, when they agree to play, they agree to follow the rules of the play. And this is how children learn how to control their impulses. This is how they learn how to follow rules. It's, I think, one of the reasons that there is such high rate of diagnosis of ADHD today is because children don't have enough opportunity to play, and they're not therefore learning how to control their impulses in the natural way that children do. I say that's one reason. The main reason is that we're just diagnosing normal child behavior as abnormal. But I do think that there may well be an actual increase in impulsivity, right, because of the fact that children are not playing enough to learn how to control their impulses.
Well, I also think coupled with then they're set in that structured school setting, which is not a natural setting for them to be in for the extended period with all those other demands being placed too. You know, the combination of those two things for a child who may, you know, already have certain things going on as well. You know, like it's very challenging for a child who has those and has not been supported through play to be under such constraint for so long as well.
Right. So then the fourth characteristic of play is that although play has rules and structured, the rules are never so rigid that as to tell you exactly what you have to do on any given move. Play always has lots of room for creativity. Play is always creative. It is something that you are constantly producing your version of what to do. You're thinking of how to do it. It is the most creative activity that anybody ever engages in. And it is how children develop their creative potential. It's impossible to teach creativity. It just blossoms. It's natural to children, but it is really developed. The creative ability is developed in play. And moreover, whereas play is always creative, it's also usually highly imaginative, especially for young children. Children play imaginative games all the time, like pretending to be Wonder Woman. And in the process of imagining, they are practicing what logicians consider to be the highest order of human reasoning, which is hypothetical deductive reasoning. The developmental psychologist Piaget years ago argued that children aren't capable of hypothetical deductive reasoning until they're 11 or 12, but he was wrong. If you observe little children playing fantasy games, you see hypothetical deductive reasoning all the time. So, for example, you might observe around your kitchen table, if you've got some little children playing there, somebody says, well, the kitchen table is a bridge. And somebody else says there's a troll under the bridge. And then somebody says, well, if there's a, so notice this is hypothesis. They know it isn't really a bridge and they know there's not really a troll under the bridge. This is about a hypothesis. We're setting up a hypothesis. They don't put it in that words or say we're pretending this is true. And then somebody says, well, if there's a troll under the bridge, we need to give the troll a cookie so it doesn't eat us. Well, that's hypothetical deductive reasoning. You know, the hypothetical, there's a troll under the bridge here. Deduction, we have to do something to keep it from eating us. Let's give it a cookie. So what I'm trying to make the point of is that children are practicing these really profound abilities in play. They're practicing how to negotiate, how to keep their friends happy. They're practicing. They're also becoming highly skilled at the activities that they're interested and passionate about, and they are practicing higher thought processes in their play.
And now a word from our sponsor, EduShape, the original sensory company. EduShape is a 40-year-old expert in child development toys that started by working as a trusted supplier of daycares and preschools, but has since expanded to support families and special education globally. It has been featured on The Today Show, The New York Times, and Cosmopolitan, Good Housekeeping, and more. Their toys are rated 5 stars by millions of consumers. And just for Father's Day, EduShape is offering 20% off all toys on EduShape.com. Shop today through June 16th to score a quality toy for your little one at a great price. So today we obviously have so many different constraints. Like, we live in a very different society than 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago. We're battling a lot, you know, to get the kids out and for playing. Can we talk a little bit about some of what those constraints are today and how we could potentially help either undo them, how we can help mitigate them, how we can help insert, like, how can we help enable more play given overscheduling? Yes, technology in some ways can be good, but in many ways is, you know, a lot. What are some of the, we're aware that it is negatively impacting our culture. I'm happy to either talk about some of the ways in which you have researched that we know that these are truly negative for them, and then also kind of touch upon some of the ways that either we can undo, help support, mitigate, et cetera, those more modern demands that are being placed on kids. Big question. Sorry, but I know you have a lot of research on this and a lot of expertise and a lot of intelligence that I
You're
want to
right
impart on.
that I have done a lot of research on this and a lot of writing on it. So the first thing I want to point out, a lot of people these days want to blame the problem of stress and lack of outdoor play on social media, on cell phones, on digital technology. I want to point out that this occurred long before we had digital technology. This problem developed long before that. That between about 2000, about 1950 and 1990 was a 40-year period in which we were gradually removing children's freedom away from them in many ways. There's no comparison between the freedom I had as a kid in the 1950s and the lack of freedom the kids already had by the 1990s. Freedom was taken away for a variety of reasons. One is the school year increased by about 5 weeks over that time. Recess was gradually removed. When I was in elementary school, we had 2 hours outdoors playing in a six-hour school day. Half hour in the middle of the morning, half hour in the middle of the afternoon, full hour at lunch. We were never in our seats for more than an hour at a time. After school, in elementary school, we were free. There was no such thing as homework in elementary school. This came later. So this idea that you're never free of school, that this has developed gradually, and it developed gradually over the second half of the 20th century. There's been an additional spurt of this more recently, since Common Core, it's gotten even worse. But the changes between 1950 and 1990 were great. So that was part of it, increased school, but also decreased acceptance of children outdoors. You used to just expect children everywhere. Of course, they're a pain in some ways. They're noisy. They trample on your grass. They're not always nice. People became less and less tolerant over time of children. And so it almost became a moral issue that parents are not supposed to let their children out in public because they might disturb people out there in public. So that became part of it. Then by the 1980s, even the early 1980s, we developed this terrible concept called stranger danger. That's strangers are dangerous, and anybody you don't know might kidnap your child, and therefore you are a negligent parent if you're not watching your child all the time, even into their teenage years. I mean, this was an extraordinary change. When I, 5-year-olds used to walk to kindergarten regularly, all by themselves or with their friends, going out and playing. You didn't need to have adults with you. That was childhood. That was also normal childhood in other cultures, and in some places, it's still normal childhood. So all of that was taken away gradually. Now, if in the 1950s, suddenly we made rules that suddenly made the 1950s like today, people would be appalled. How can you possibly expect children to spend that much time sitting in school? How can you possibly confine them to home unless you go out with them all the time? That would seem crazy, absolutely crazy. But because it happened gradually, so that from 1 year to the next, it wasn't even noticeable, we just accepted it. We just accepted these awful changes in the way children are being raised. Now, this reached a peak in the 1990s. And also, I've also looked at the rates of suicide among school-age children, the rates of anxiety and depression. Those were increasing at the same rate that freedom was decreasing between 1950 and 1990, and reached a peak in 1990. Interestingly, that peak in 1990 was about the same level as it is today. Now, then, between 1990 and the beginning of the 20th century, over a 10-year period, and then a little bit into the 20th century, those things declined. rates of suicide, rates of anxiety, rates of depression among kids declined a little bit, not all the way back by any means to what they were in the 1950s, but declined a significant amount. Why did they decline? My theory is it's not that we suddenly gave children freedom that we had taken away from them. It's that they discovered a new freedom. That is the freedom that came with technology. So the internet, the computers, the internet, video games, we weren't allowing kids to get together in person. That had already peaked by the 1990s, but now they could get together virtually and they could play with one another. They could communicate with one another. They could do what kids always have done. But now they couldn't, and they couldn't do it in person. They couldn't get together in person, but they could get together over the internet. And the other thing that happened, and again, I lived through this, is that suddenly teenagers had, especially teenagers, had a lot of authority because they're the ones who figured out how to use these computers. And they taught their parents
you're
how
speaking
to do it.
You're speaking to my childhood. I'm like, yes, us on AOL. No,
yeah. No, and so they gained, so the kids became the competent ones, and that led to a certain amount of pride, a certain amount of respect. You would go to into a department store like Sears that was still existing at that time, to the computer section, and very likely there'd be a teenager there as the salesperson explaining to middle-aged adults how these devices work. So suddenly there was a new freedom. Kids could play, and it was real play. It had the disadvantage that it's not outdoors with fresh air and a lot of vigorous exercise, but it's still play and satisfies many of the requirements of play. It's fully play, and children are learning to interact socially because so much of the games became social. They're learning how to follow rules. They're learning how to be creative because the games are highly creative. And so all of these things happened, and they got better. But then what happened in beginning about 2010? Now, most people want to attribute the rise after 2010 to social media and so on. And I've really examined that evidence, and I'm not convinced of it, nor are most of the people who actually do research in this area. The people ringing the alarm about it are not people who actually have been doing the research and writing about the from a research point of view. And I could go on and on, but I won't here. That's a different topic about that. What really changed, in my opinion, is schools changed. They became even much worse than before. And the way they changed, the reason they changed is because of Common Core. So Common Core in most states came into effect. And even when it didn't come officially into effect, it came practically into effect. In most states, beginning between 2010 and 2012, it dramatically altered what could happen in the classroom. Prior to that, teachers had a lot of responsibility, a lot of freedom in the classroom to teach the way they felt best. They could vary their teaching in accordance with what they perceived to be the needs of the children. They could go off onto digressions and talk about intellectually interesting things that engage the children. And they could modify a little bit what they're doing to different kids who had somewhat different interests. All of that, they could do creative things. They could spend a whole day decorating for holidays. They could spend time writing plays and putting them on and writing poetry in ways that isn't even graded, but it's just the fun to write poetry. So all these things were largely taken away with Common Core, because with Common Core, teachers lost their freedom to do what they want. With Common Core, whole school districts began to be evaluated based on these standardized tests that were being given. That was the whole basis now for evaluating schools. How do the scores improve or decline or stay the same from year to year in your school? Superintendents are being evaluated that way. Principals of schools and teachers are being evaluated that way. When that's the way you are being evaluated, you get very anxious about those test scores. You make every change in school that you can almost to improve those test scores that you think are going to improve those test scores. It turns out they really don't, but you think they're going to improve. You take away recess, so you've got more time to prepare for tests. You shorten the lunch hour. You take away the courses that aren't tested on or reduce their emphasis, like music and art and things like that. That used to be kind of fun. So these changes, there's no question but what these changes have made school far more anxiety-provoking than it was before. And they're doing this even in kindergarten. Little children are being stressed. They're coming home burned out. Kindergarten used to be just a place to play, to get used to being
home. Kindergartner has homework. Yeah.
And giving homework to kindergarten. So I've done studies about the harm this has done. It's clearly harmful, and it produces long-term harm. It's traumatic to these little children. It's a traumatic experience. And it in some ways is harmful for life, at least through the life of school. That there's research studies that I've summarized showing that kids who are subjected to this early academic drill and homework in the long run perform worse later on in school and by every measure, and especially by social and emotional measures, than kids who just had play at that time. This is well established. But our school system pays no attention to this research.
I'm going to gather all of this. I'm going to add it into the footer notes so everyone can see it. We're going to start building cases for this because we have to take back the schools very clearly. And I can go this topic, I could go on and on and on, particularly for the profiles of my children. I see the negative implications for them. You know, I have three children. I can very clearly see it. And I'm in that kind of sweet window that you're describing. I have a pre-K, a K, and a first grade, you know, so I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it in real time right now. And I will definitely be following up to get more information on that and for sharing it with the group. Just being mindful of time, I do want to kind of touch on maybe some practical tips that we can give to parents for how can they help set up a more ideal play environment. You know, so you talked about a lot of the ways in which this is defining what play is. How as parents, like, what can I be doing to help create an environment in my own home? You know, I may not be able to control the school, but in my house, what are some of the things that I can be doing in my play environment and or to help facilitate this? Obviously, if somebody
I would suggest, first of all, thinking beyond just your house and trying to think about the neighborhood.
I love that.
So one thing that parents can do, and there are some places, some neighborhoods where parents have done it, is to deliberately get to know the other parents who have kids in your neighborhood. And get to know them, get together, talk to them about the importance of play, talk to them about, you know, maybe their own memories of play as a child and the value of play, and maybe show them some of the research. I mean, just have a little discussion with them, figure out some tactful way of doing this over coffee at your house or something.
I started a play podcast to promote it for my community and for my friends.
That's right.
I'm known as the Playhouse.
Talk about how difficult it is to find kind of a normal play opportunity. It used to be the kids just went outdoors, or, you know, in the world I grew up in, moms everywhere shooed their kids. They didn't want the kids in the house. Get out of the house. You know, it was for a lot of reasons. Houses were smaller, families were bigger. You needed to get the kids out of your hair, so you'd send them outdoors. And all other moms are sending their kids outdoors, and so there's a lot of kids outdoors, and they're playing with one another. We're also back in the 50s, to be honest, many more kids, so that's a thing that played a role also. But if you can get the parents to think about this and say, so how could we kind of replicate this in a safe enough way in our own neighborhood? And so what if we, at certain hours, maybe every Saturday afternoon and certain weekdays after school, we acted like old-fashioned parents and we just all sent our kids outdoors? You have to get out of the house. It's a requirement. I'm shooing you out. And other parents are doing the same thing. So there's a bunch of kids outdoors. If there are somewhat older kids with cell phones, leave the cell phone inside. That stays inside. You're going out with no cell phone. This is one thing I have against technology is if you've been used to technology, it's hard to separate yourself from it. So to play, keep the cell phone indoors. So the and if some parents are worried about it, have at least have one adult out there, could be a parent. My preference generally is that it would be a grandparent because grandparents are less likely to intervene than parents are in my experience, although that's not necessarily always true.
I was going to say, generationally, I actually think we have some nervous grandparents now. So yeah. Remind the grandparents, it's okay. It's okay.
So who's out there just for safety, who's not out there to tell the kids how to play or solve little problems or anything like that, just there for safety, not there to be tattled on, tattled to about other kids. That's just your only role is to be like a lifeguard on Ocean Beach. If there's a real emergency, step in. But otherwise, it's for the kids to solve the problem. That's the whole purpose of play. Now, there are a few neighborhoods that have actually done this and quite successfully. So it can be done, but it takes initiative to do it. There are some other things that can be done, simpler things like when you go on a family vacation, don't think of it just as family time. Think of it as a time for some change in everybody's life. And part of that change is for the kids to have an opportunity to play with kids and be away from their parents. So go on a vacation, maybe to a camp, an interesting camping area with other families who have kids. And now the kids have somebody to play with, and they can run off and play, and the adults can sit around the campfire or whatever the adults are going to do, talking about adult things, doing adult things, playing adult games, while the kids are having fun with other kids. So that's another thing that I encourage parents to do, and it's not that hard to do as long as you can find other families interested in doing it. It might be uncles and aunts of the kids, but it might just be friends that you have that would be interested in that kind of thing. The other thing you can do, even though there are limitations of what you can do with school, through the Let Grow nonprofit organization that Lenore Scanese and I have been very involved in and helped found, we have brought free play and adventure into typical schools. And we talked earlier on about Michael Hines, superintendent,
who pioneered some of it. You got to bring it. Got to bring it to Port Washington.
Yeah. So one of the things we brought to schools is what's called Play Club, which is an hour of free play either before or after school, where all the kids in all the classes in all the grades in elementary school are playing together, and they have lots of things to play with, lots of space to play. Ideally, they have the outdoor playground, the gymnasium, the hallways between the gym and the outdoor playground, sometimes the art room, sometimes other rooms that have games and puzzles and so on in them. So there's a lot of different ways to play, and then the whole range of ages of people to play with, lots of playmates. And when in Play Club, we instruct the teachers who monitor it, because it usually is teachers monitoring it, that while you're watching Play Club, you're not a teacher. You're not there to tell the kids how to play. You're not there to solve little problems. You're definitely not there to be tattled to by other kids, by kids. You are there like a lifeguard on an ocean beach. You're there for an emergency. And even then, if you think it's an emergency, but it's not an immediate emergency, count to 10 before you intervene. And chances are the kids will have solved the problem themselves. So the whole purpose of play is for kids to solve their problems. Now, at first, I thought teachers wouldn't be able to follow this because they're so oriented towards helping and teaching. But it turns out they can, and they've been amazed that they don't have to intervene. Very rarely do they have to intervene. The kids are incredible at solving their own problems when they understand that it's their job to do it and nobody is going to intervene. So this has been very successful when it's been done. A growing number of schools are doing it. Some libraries are beginning to do something like this at the library. And so another thing that parents could do is get on the library board The friends of the library, and try to talk the library into sponsoring play at the library every once in a while, free play at the library. I know one school in Texas that that every Saturday afternoon they open up the library for play. They put up a big sign that says "Joyful Noise Welcome." They have a quiet room in the back of the library for people who want to use it for traditional library purposes, but they have sometimes 100 kids that are playing and exploring, not only in the library, but also at the library grounds. They have lots of ways of play, and they do this sometimes after school as well. This has been very successful. It's brought people to the library who otherwise would never be going to the library, it meets a need in the community. So that's another thing, another way of working in the community to try to bring places where kids can congregate and play that are regarded as safe enough by parents because there's one or more adults there for safety, but is still free play because the adults there are deliberately not intervening.
I was going to say, I feel like I have my marching orders. So one, I'm recruiting the grandparents. All the grandparents are now on call. They're going to rotate. I'm getting Dr. Hines on board. We're going to be facilitating this. I open up my house, my backyard, my playroom. You know, my husband's going to, he's like, all of a sudden, we're going to just have, this has actually happened on several occasions where there'll be like 50 kids in my house. So like, I'm a big proponent of this. And we're kind of the open door policy in our house. You know, kids are welcome in, they go outside, et cetera. Right. I'm just going to have to increase the scaling of this. So I hope my husband's not listening to this and that he will be supportive when it starts to happen. So I think that those are, you know, again, really helpful for one. Yes, we can be speaking about this, lobbying for this, et cetera, in the libraries, asking our teachers, asking our superintendents, and also just being mindful that within the community, we can just do it with a few of our friends and start there. And, you know, the idea of having different ages and all the benefits of that, I think is just, it's a helpful reminder of play, the importance of play, the benefit of play. Let's let them do it. It's their job. It's not our job. It's their job. They should be doing it. You know, I had to learn the count to 10 rule for myself, you know, and it is like my kids solve it. They solve it on their own, and they're different ages. So different levels of, you know, capability and whatnot. But they navigate it. You know, if I, sometimes I'll even go to a 15 count. This morning I got to 15 and it was solved by 14. So, you know, sometimes you can extend it a little bit. But I think that, again, all of those opportunities that we're creating to allow them to do problem solving, to do imaginative play, to do all these things, you know, we could be observers and that's okay. But enabling them to do all of that. And I think, like, again, in my space, we try to create an area that we have a large open place so that they can be doing some more physical things. We have a lot of what would be considered open-ended play materials that they get to give meaning to those toys. You know, it's not this, it's not already pre-prescribed. This is how you have to use it. Of course, they can always override that, but just giving them these kind of open-ended tools to do it. So I think that that's all incredibly valuable and important. And yes, I will be following up with you to get all the information so that we can add it in and share it with everyone who's listening. And I feel like I have about 500 different podcasts I want to have with you now on each of these different topics. But just being mindful of your time, I'm going to go into kind of a quick rapid fire round, asking you a handful of questions. And then I'll give you an opportunity if there's anything else, resource or insight wise, you want to have. But I'm going to politely demand that you come back on again in a little bit so we can continue the conversation. So first up, what was your favorite play activity as a child?
So it depended so much on where I lived. We moved a lot and what age I was. So in one town, for example, I was really into fishing. I was fishing, but when I was 10, 11 years old, I was fishing, sometimes skipping school to go fishing, to be honest. My friends were into
fishing. You know the benefits of that. It's okay.
There was a town that I lived in before that, where this was in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, where baseball was the big thing. Pick up baseball. This was when I was 8, 9 into 10. We played endless amounts of baseball in a vacant lot. making up our own games, kids of various ages. I would have been one of the younger kids, but I was convinced I was going to be a Major League Baseball player then. And we played constantly. We also, Sun Prairie is a very flat place, so it was easy to find vacant lots that are flat for baseball, but also it's a great place for kite flying. And we used to make our own kites and fly them. And it was almost like a game to see who could get their kites to fly the highest and the longest. It was also because I was in Wisconsin and then in northern Minnesota for much of my childhood, winter sports, ice skating on the ponds. We played a lot of hockey, but it was not formal hockey. We made up our own. We'd shovel off the snow from the lake and play games of hockey that way. When I was my earliest play memory, which is I've just been thinking about lately, it was when I was 4 years old. And at that time, we lived in a big city in Minneapolis in a working class neighborhood and on a very busy street, I might say. And there was a vacant lot next door to us that was a very weedy vacant lot. And I have this vivid memory of going out there and playing with the person who was my best friend at that time. His name was Ira, an African-American kid, 2 years older than me, who was my hero. And what I remember that I appreciated best about him is he taught me how to catch grasshoppers. And we would put grasshoppers into jars that he had punched holes in. And it gave me, as I think back about it, it's sort of was my first taste of the value of mixed age play, where he's a little more advanced than me and could do these more advanced things. And in the process of play, could show me how to do it. You know, if some adult had done this with me, it might have been worth doing, but it wouldn't have been as exciting as if this amazing kid that is not so much older than me that I couldn't emulate him showed me how to do it. So those are some of the examples. There's no single case. I often have thought I'm kind of lucky that we moved around a lot, because in every neighborhood I lived, kids played at different things. And of course, you want to play with other kids. And so you learn to enjoy what they're playing at. And so I had the experience of being able to play a lot of different things as I grew up. And I think that it led me to be maybe more well-rounded in my interests and abilities than would otherwise have occurred.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so today, as an adult, what is your most enjoyable, playful activity?
So I've always been an outdoor person, and that's still true. So my play is outdoor play, and it's especially true because of the fact that my writing and podcasts and all that kind of stuff that I do is indoors. So I want to spend as much time when I'm not doing that stuff outdoors as possible. So the things I do outdoors, which are at least very playful, if not fully play, are my vegetable gardening, which I have a great vegetable garden and a real passion about it, but also a lot of vigorous physical activities. So kayaking, we live on a river and I go kayaking regularly up the river and back. Bicycling, I typically will, I'll go through periods where for months on end, I'll take a 20 mile ride every morning on my bike, which I've always enjoyed bicycling. That's something that's been constant all through my childhood and adulthood, as I love bicycling. Cross-country skiing in the winter, backwoods skiing in the winter. We have a wood stove, and it's play for me when a neighbor's tree falls down, I'll volunteer to cut it up and bring it over to my yard for firewood. This is all play. It's not something I would really, for economic purposes, have to do. So these are some of the ways I play, and it's somewhat, I have to say, you know, it's not just that I love to do these things, which I do, but also I have to say I kind of deliberately choose to play in these ways because I know it's good for me. I'm 80 years old, and some people succumb to let some people grow old when they're 80 because they stop doing vigorous things. And I've sort of made a point of continuing to do vigorous things, only vigorous things that I enjoy. Like I would never go to a gym and work out. Why would you do that?
You're growing very usefully.
I would never, you know, I used to jog, think it was good for me. I don't like jogging. I love bicycling and I love cross-country skiing, but I don't like jogging, so I don't jog.
It's funny that you say that. For a while I was jogging. I don't like jogging. And I just recently got back into tennis. I used to play a lot as a child and it was actually not one of my most like competitive sports. I did competitive sports, but this was more like true joyful and playful for me. Right. And I picked it up again. And every time I leave the court, I am giddy. Like I am just a happier, better version of myself. And so I've started to pick up a few other ones. I started paddle boarding again. Like I love being in nature. I love being in the water. And it's just, and my husband knows when I'm having like a tough day or whatever, he's like, get on the water, go hit some balls, you know, whatever it might be. And it's, I agree. Like it's, I think in some, as much as the decline is happening, obviously for kids and we need to, you know, intercept this and do what we can for it. Also as grownups, like I'm sure there are massive bodies of research around how we're losing it. We're like very much losing the sense of playfulness and how important it is for us to do it too. So find your passion and your delight, throwing the ball, whatever it might be for you. For me right now, tennis and paddleboard. But no, it does. It brings me back to a set. I feel it. I just like innately feel more youthful. I feel more energized. I feel more regulated. Is there a particular object that you have found or a toy that kind of universally unlocks play for kids? You know, we talked about a lot, you know, obviously letting the kid find their passion, their purpose, whatever. But is there a particular object that you have found, you know, a block, a ball or whatever that is like, this is going to work for all kids kind of thing?
I don't think there's any particular object. I mean, so I think that the way to know if a toy works for a kid is whether the kid chooses it and whether the kid, you know, that what we try to do at Play Club is to have a wide variety of things to play with. So there are balls, there are hula hoops, there's jump ropes. There's puzzles and games.
Hula hooping yesterday. I forgot how much I love hula hooping. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just hula hooped yesterday for the first time in decades, and I was reverberating afterwards. Sorry.
Yeah, good for you. I mean, kids love these kinds of things: jump roping, hopscotch, things you can draw on the pavements. These are all simple things. And I think just by providing, you know, the opportunities for those things, I think it's a mistake to try to predict what a child will like and then spend money to get that thing. You know, I mean, if you can borrow it and the child really loves it and, you know, then get it. But one of the things at this school that I was describing at the beginning, in terms of their buying equipment, they never bought equipment, any kind of equipment, unless the kids asked for it and demonstrated that they really wanted it. And oftentimes, one of the requirements was they had to earn some of the money by sponsoring cookie sales or something like that in the school. And so the idea of actually the child taking some responsibility for getting this thing they want, that's the evidence that they really want it. I think that we tend to think, you know, we should be giving things to kids on the basis, well, we think this would be good for them, or we think that we believe they would enjoy it or should enjoy it. But I think that normally I think the initiative should come from the kid.
All right. Very last one. If you wish all parents knew one thing about play, just one, what would it be?
Well, I think the thing to know, you know, I mean, this is going to seem redundant with everything else, but the thing to know is that children are designed to play. They absolutely need play. They don't need to be told how to play. But they need the opportunity to play. They need lots of opportunity to play. And primarily what they need is other kids to play with. Bring
I
it
just
to the
want to
club.
say thank you. It was such a pleasure speaking with you. I'm so grateful for your time, for your insight, for your knowledge, your expertise. And we'll be sure to share more resources and information with everyone who's listening. So thank you again so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. It's been a pleasure. Have a good rest of the day. But
have a wonderful day. Thank you, Dr. Gray.
You are very welcome.
For more information on sensory play activities and resources, be sure to check out the links in the show notes below. And of course, don't forget to like, share, subscribe to this channel and our sponsor, EduShape's Instagram page for more insightful tips and conversation around all things toys and child development.